Welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, sponsored by the National Association of Independent Artists.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. I'm Will Armstrong, and I'm a mixed media artist.
I'm Douglas Sigworth, glassblower. Join our conversations with professional working artists.
Hello there.
How's it going?
Good. Are you sitting in your little closet there? It looks a little more spacious.
My little closet? Yeah. No, I'm out of the closet, Douglas. I'm out. I had to build a new closet. I've been doing a lot of shipping. And so I slowly deconstructed my closet and had to ship it. And so Temple Beth El has my current sound booth, if you will.
Okay.
All of my stuff went into boxes and shipped to them. Those ladies running that show could not be any more lovely. I'm a huge fan of that show.
So yeah, me too.
Fingers crossed that it's lucrative. But
Yeah. I hope it's good for you. I really miss out being there. I've had to snooze a lot of my social media posts this past 2 weeks, seeing all the fun in Florida.
I'm not doing Florida at all. It's nice to be home.
That's true.
Do I look a little tanner? Am I a little tan?
You do have some color. Even over a Zoom here, I can see some color.
That's right. Went to Mexico for a week with my lovely wife, just to kind of reset.
Nice.
It was a tradition we have not been able to do since before COVID. So went and had a little reset vacation and used up some airline and hotel points and went and ate quite a bit of fresh food and Mexican food and seafood. I eat pretty much seafood every meal because I'm in a bit of a seafood wasteland here in New Mexico.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, did it work? I mean, do you feel recharged and ready to face the year? That's good.
Yep. Ready to go. You know, I did not sit down on the beach and come up with ideas like I have in the past. I got the ideas, but let's just get to work.
That's kind of what I've been struggling with. I'm sick of being in my head. I'm sick of thinking about things. I am all about wanting to get out there and just get to it. I'm ready to have some action.
Mm-hmm.
But what's helped me this week with that to slow my roll is I saw a 60 Minutes interview with Rick Rubin. You know who Rick Rubin is, right? I'm sure he's...
Yeah, I love Rick Rubin. Everything from, you know, the Beastie Boys to the Avett Brothers.
Do you know anything about his, like, personal style? Like kind of who he is as a person?
Yeah, a little bit, but only snippets, you know, here and there. Like I catch a snippet of an interview. He produced one of my favorite Tom Petty albums, the Wildflowers album. And what I remember from him was like Tom Petty was like, all right, well, use the keyboard and let's get some strings in here. And he's like, you're fucking Tom Petty. We're not going to use the keyboard for the strings. So they go and they hire the LA Philharmonic to do the strings.
Interesting.
Because it's like, well, why not? You can afford it. Let's make it sound right. So he boils things down and gets to the very basic root of what's good about an artist is what I love.
They featured him on 60 Minutes and he's got a book coming out. Mm. The book is called The Creative Act, A Way of Being, which I can't wait to look into that. Because he does. He reduces things down. But the biggest thing with him is all about removing the distractions. And there are so many distractions in this business. You know, looking into what's going on out in the world can really stifle the creativity. That is going to be my New Year's resolution, is to remove those distractions. Shut the phone off. Leave it across the room. Leave it in the house, for crying out loud. The whole idea of just clearing away the clutter and just seeing what special stuff comes up, what new surprises come out of it.
He's an amazing producer, and it doesn't matter whether he's producing Jay-Z, 99 Problems, which was his kind of throwback bringing heavy metal back into hip hop, or whether it's cutting like the Avett Brothers or Tom Petty down to the most raw form, or Johnny Cash. He completely revitalized Johnny Cash's career. So
I love that whole, I mean, to hear Johnny Cash sing that Nine Inch Nails song in such a different point of view was just brilliant.
He recognized that Cash was an interpreter of song as much as he was a writer. But like Elvis was like one of the greatest interpreters of song of all time, Johnny Cash the same way. And hearing Johnny Cash sing Hurt, it becomes not about heroin abuse, but about the loss of his wife and him coming to the end of his life. So Rick Rubin always kind of brought that out. I can't wait to read that book. I'm not kidding now. I mean, I was joking last week we were talking and now I'm like, fucking A,
book club?
Independent Artist Book Club. Let's do this.
Sure. In this, the talk that resonated with me, he tries to come at it from a totally clean slate. Every if he's got a bunch of demo tapes or whatever. I think you mentioned Tom Petty earlier.
Oh, yeah. Wildflowers.
yeah, he listened to this whole demo tape and he came back to him and he was excited because out of that whole demo tape, most of it was nothing in Rick Rubin's mind, but this one guitar riff.
Yeah.
And he goes, this guitar riff is going to be your whole new direction. So he could pick out these seeds that then blossomed into making somebody the best that they could be or what their actual unique sound was. And really, if there's too much distraction going on, we can't be in tune with that creative voice.
Right. Yeah, I'm with that. You know, when I was talking about going down to Mexico, and it's like one of the big things that I did was leave my phone in the room and go down to the beach and just I just swam and I read and I hung out with my wife and I had some beers.
Like real experiences. Like,
yeah, you know, I just kind of opened. And the thing is, man, when you go back to your phone, it's like you look at it and you're like, yeah, what if I got like 3 alerts here? I'm like, well, did I really need to know that you posted another promo for the podcast? I didn't need to
That'll
know
That'll happen
it.
whether you're present or not.
Whether the sun is shining or not. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Going down. But man, speaking of social media, you mentioned this to me earlier. You were wanting to talk about some of the things going down.
Well, it seems like lately people are getting a little heated around some topics like the whole taking photos in the booth again. I mean, what are your thoughts about it?
I've got what? 2 thoughts.
Okay.
All right. One of my thoughts is, you know why people are getting heated? It's because it's January.
Yeah.
And a lot
chomping
of
chomping at the bit. Yeah.
There are, like, I'd say there's a good 80% of the art show artists that work from March to end of September. And
sure.
that gives you October, November, then the holidays with the family. And then the stress of January coming around, all the goddamn booth fees are due in January. You're basically, we are a store, right? We're a store that's open maybe, I don't know, 8 to 15 weekends of the year. And our business expects the rent to be due for that entire year coming up in January, right after the holidays. So you've got that stress going on. Nobody's working.
The bank accounts are getting thin.
Oh, real thin. We start to, you know, completely depleted. And all these, you know, you're lucky enough to get into a good show season. You got to pay for it ahead of time. So I had to bring that up in order to bring up, I don't know that people are really that angry about photos and booths as much as they are just sitting at their goddamn screen, just looking at it and gnashing their teeth.
Right.
So anyway.
And maybe if somebody is feeling strongly one way or the other, that somebody might just ignore the other point of view if they weren't already so hypercharged and raring for a fight.
Right. Exactly. So you ask me a question.
So then back to the actual, the whole point of it is, what do you think about photos in the booth? How do you react to it?
90% of the time, the people who are taking photos of the booth are sharing it with their husband or wife to see if they want to buy it.
Right. Why would we want to shut any of that down?
Yeah. Don't share it with your husband. Tell him to go away. Both of you, get out. Like, so no, I don't hang anything in my booth that says no photos. I don't say, you know, I said this before on the podcast. I don't say no in my booth. I don't ever say no to anybody. So if somebody even comes up and we're like, okay, my work is acrylic, it's ink, it's mixed media. Decoupage is when you glue some stamps or something to a lamp, right? I mean, it's not decoupage. So people come into my booth and they're like, oh my gosh, is this decoupage? No, it's not decoupage, but I don't say that. They're like, yeah, you're right. It is. It's actually collage work. So if they're wrong, I still say, yes, you're right. Is this a photograph? Yes, it does look like a photograph. Thanks so much for thinking that it looks that way. It's actually hand-drawn. So it's always yes, it's pumping them up. Maybe I'm an old hippie, but signs everywhere. There's a sign. I don't care. You know, you're like, can I take a photo? Yes. And then they bring out the soft lights and start framing it up in their HD camera.
Like, now hit the road. Whoa.
No. Yeah. No,
or I shut down the drive-bys. I mean, I'll walk up to somebody who might just be walking by with camera in hand just to sneak in. It's like usually the camera comes out if there's a conversation going and it sounds like they want to share it with a spouse or like you said. So I try to keep the energy vibe in the booth welcoming versus always on edge and combative, like, don't do that. I mean, that even with kids, don't do that can just really bring the energy down in the booth. And We are trying to sell stuff.
In spite of how I sound on the show, I try not to be a jerk. Like, I really focus on not being a jerk. And I try not to, you know, try to be likable, try to be open and honest with people.
And the other point about it that hits me is we work so hard to create original work.
Sure.
And we find a way that we can get it in front of people's faces so they'll buy it. But then to be completely riding the line of, when is it seen too much? Do you not put it on social media? Do you not put it on a website because you don't want it to be stolen, quote unquote, or copied? It is something that gets in the way of that interaction of your designs getting in front of the buyers, I feel like, if it's like you're trying to protect it from being stolen all the time.
I've got a very dear friend that's dealing with this whack-a-mole thing right now where their designs have been stolen, like off of their Instagram, off of their website, sent to China and mass produced. And now that artist is going through and they literally are playing this kind of whack-a-mole game where they're going to all these people who are now trying to distribute their designs and being like, this is stolen. This is stolen. This is stolen, you know, and they're getting it taken down. They've had these certain things approved, but I mean, it's an awful feeling. So I get it. And my designs, if you shoot it correctly, or you take it off of a website, or you take it off my website, or even Zaps. I mean, here's a weird story for you.
Okay.
I was chosen years ago as the poster artist for a prestigious show. And they're like, hey, we want to use this on this image. You know, it was one of my Zap images for the application. I'm like, awesome. Let me send you the high res. I sent them the high res and they didn't use it. They used my Zap to print the poster.
Okay.
And so it's like, look, 1920 by 1920, you know, we have all people complaining about
it's not high res enough to do professional.
You wouldn't think it was, but it looked great.
Did it?
And
okay.
I could tell by the little corner image of, because I dusted my signature out of it.
Oh yeah.
And I sent them the high res with my signature on it.
Yeah.
And you know, you have to obviously, you know, when you're applying to Zap, you got to have your signature dusted. Whatever. So it aren't any marks on it. So and I was like, oh my God, they used the wrong thing and it still looked great. So our stuff is out there.
Yeah.
It's super stealable.
Yeah.
I respect other people's opinions on how they feel on whether they want to have pictures taken. I just, it's already out there.
Other people. Yeah. I don't hold it against, because I'm not a 2D artist and my work is difficult to steal. So I understand it is a real issue for people. Pardon me.
Whatever. I'm going to 3D print it out of plastic.
There you go. Hey, but say you brought up the poster artist thing, and I do want to give a shout out to our past guest and good friend, Ben Fry. His image is being used on Coconut Grove's promotions and poster this year. So congrats to him.
Congrats to him. And also congrats to Coconut Grove, because for years and years, they would go outside of our community and get some artist that they thought was just somebody fun or whatever, and they'd sell their images on coffee cups and
like more commercial and all that kind of thing.
Very commercial artist. Yeah. And the fact that Camille Marchese is taking that show and doing some things with it that she, I believe, learned from her experiences at Winter Park and is starting to prop that show up. I just feel like it's amazing to have a show of that caliber back in such good hands. So hats off to her and the rest of her team for that decision, and a huge congrats.
It's definitely a thing that puts art in the forefront again, which is what we want from our art fairs and festivals, is to make it be not a big entertainment event, but an art event.
And one of our own. Too.
Yeah,
I mean, Benjamin is like, his work is it's really suitable to posters. It really it brings that kind of excitement and entertainment value to it as well. He's done a couple in the past that I thought of. He did Des Moines and he's doing this one. And I'm excited for him. I'm excited for the show.
Yeah, that's great. So another thing I saw recently was there have been several art fair mock juries that have been going on. Privately, and I know like St. Louis has done this, and I was reading some threads about how people reacted to the comments about the booth image. I know we come back to that from time to time where people have opinions about it, and some of the reactions, okay, was like, oh,
I got one.
The whole issue about the booth image is, you know, we're trying to get into a show. We're trying to show our actual real booth. But then you start getting feedback from, well, there's too many pieces in the booth. It's too crowded. There's grass in the booth. It's like, Are we then are we being told to stage a booth so that it's acceptable? And then do we show up with a staged booth, or are we really showing a real booth? What's the deal?
I was at a Howard Allen show and talking to Debbie Allen, and she comes over to me and she was like, she's just bitching. She's just complaining, just bitterly complaining about, like just has cartoon curse words and bubbles coming out of her mouth. I'm like, what's going on? And she was like, look at your neighbor. And he had these blue plastic tarps up as his wall. And he had his paintings with hooks, like drapery hooks, just jabbed through the blue plastic. And he's hanging all this stuff. It was a hacky booth.
Yeah.
So, and she was like, look at this guy's booth shot. And there's the fake booth shot with the pro panels and the carpet and all of this stuff. And he doesn't even own it.
It's
just a Photoshopped booth. And there are services online of people who are doing that for people and just putting together some nonsense booth. And it's
ridiculous.
Like,
yeah,
the booth shot to me is only context. It shows me the context of that. And be like, oh, now I understand. And
sure.
So if you have all of these fakers who are out there faking it and they're trying to tweak it the certain way and cut the grass and do it and Photoshop level it out, it's like, it's not only is it dishonest, once you get into the show with your bullshit blue plastic drapery hook booth, you're not getting in again.
I understand your point about that. I mean, that's so blatantly counter to what the booth shot is for, to show up with a booth that was completely fabricated. But what about those kind of in the middle who have a somewhat of a professional display? They're having trouble getting into shows and they're like chasing their tail with the comments. Like one thing I heard was, well, the work from the individual images need to actually be in that booth shot. Well, not all artists can have it that way, that the booth shot represents the exact jury images that are in their booth, unless they cut and paste and Photoshop work that was made and sold, original work that was made and sold. But it could still be the flavor. It's not like it's a complete departure from what they do.
I mean, I make new work all the time, and it, you can tell it's my style. You can tell it's me. You're rolling through it, and you're like, okay, I use the booth image as, all right, here's my professional display. I feel like all of these services are actually doing people a disservice, because I don't think it has anything to do with the magic application. If they're into you, they're into you. If they're not, they're not. If your style is recognizable. I saw a photographer online. He's like, well, I haven't figured out the magic order to put my slides in order to get into the show that I want to get into. It's like,
the order isn't the key.
It's not the order, dude. It's just you. They're just not into you this week. And they're just not. That's not the show they're trying to put together. It's a bummer. It happens to me, you know.
Right, both of us. Like, yeah, all of us.
We all get rejections, and they're just like, look, likely it came down to me and like five other people that they felt like that style wanted, you know, a representation of, and they chose somebody else. I'm super bummed about it. I see your smug ass sitting there in your Jazz Fest cap.
Oh, shut up.
I see it. We're on Zoom. I didn't get Jazz. I've never gotten Jazz.
No, but somebody did get a few good ones, which I'm not going to point out here. So, yeah, we can put together a good season, right? That's what we're doing. We're putting together a good season.
We can all put together the season that we deserve.
I think aside from all of the, let's say, the feedback that maybe an image gets in these mock juries, what's more important is just actually go to an actual jury, a virtual or whatnot, just to be able to see what you're up against, because that always helps us to kind of know context, I think.
Absolutely.
More so than if you cut the grass, it's going to, in your image, it's going to fix it. If you do two less pieces on this pedestal, it's going to fix it. That kind of thing is just going to get you chasing your tail.
Yeah. It doesn't really matter if your walls are white or if they're gray.
Really, ultimately.
They're looking for a professional display. Show a professional display with a decent shot. Don't try to get cute with it. Don't try to. I did a booth shot one time where I opened it up. I spread it wide, or I did like rejection. You know, don't get cute. Just what does it look like? Show people what it looks like. You're not going to get yourself in trouble. You need to gnash your teeth over it.
Sure. Okay, another topic. AI art. What do you think about that? That's another conversation.
I feel like I got a big old crank in my back and just winding me up.
Can you go? What do you think about it? That's another topic we're all worrying about is AI art.
it's a personal business. It's mm-hmm. it's people want to come out. The people that want to buy from us want to meet us. They yeah. want to come buy from me. They want to meet me. They want to have a decent human on their wall. They want to have an installation of this sculptor who they talked to, and this person, they found out what that means. Oh. They want to buy from the working artist, right?
Right.
And so this AI is, it's another cheat code, right? It's another, it's another, oh, let me do this. And honestly, I thought it was cute. At first, when I see all of my friends posting, they're feeding their images onto things.
Like their profile pics, like right yeah, in the AI technology pics. With, yeah, different
Absolutely.
Images.
Our good friend Gregory Story, I love him. He's an incredible artist and ceramic artist. And he fed his images into this AI thing and makes himself look like a romantic sci-fi
superhero
superhero or yeah. book cover or whatever, and it's awesome, you know, it's fun.
I can see that being a fun thing for people to do, like with like it's an extension of say like Snapchat that my kids do, or you know what sure. I mean, things with filters or that sort of thing.
Or I mean, it's almost like a more complicated version of like, you know, which Disney princess are you, and it's there like well yeah. side note, I'm Little Mermaid, but you know, that's beside the point. But you know, it's like it's fun, it's like I don't give a shit, it's fun. But then all of a sudden it dark real quick.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right. Well, I think maybe it could affect the collectors or the artists whose collectors are looking for maybe decorative art, if we say that it's just like something not... interesting and unique. But anyone who is really collecting original art, that kernel is the same. They're not looking for the finished product. They're looking for what was dreamt up by a human who has yeah. creativity.
The problem is going to be, once again, when you start jurying in under digital, and you said it's like decorative art, but it, what I found it to be really more damaging to was illustrative art, these mm-hmm. illustrations, and where you plug in four lines from a Nick Cave song and you get a painting. Mm-hmm. And there are two Nick Caves, sorry about this, but okay. I'm talking about the musician artist, not okay. not the fine artist. Somebody had fed in a bunch of his songs and then gotten a feedback of like this BS, here's a Nick Cave song. Mm-hmm. And then he had a really great take on it. And I encourage you to follow his Red Right Hand Files. If you are okay. a fan of honestly just art or music or anything, he's just a brilliant guy, even just spirituality and religion and what it means to be an artist or even a fan of art.
Cool.
But he just ripped them a new one. So that's pretty interesting. Just talk about the integrity of what it takes to come from something with a soul.
Yeah.
And it's a grotesque mockery of what it means to be an artist. And I find it hurting people that have character to their work. I would love to ask like Beth Bajorski what she thinks of it. I kind of have an idea, but I think that would be really cool to get her take on that because she has such character driven and such care within those pieces, the soul that it takes to create that. We already know there are cheaters out there. You know, there are artists that are making their work in analog and then they're pitching it as digital so that they're the only people on the street that can sell reproductions. In an originals only show. We already know those people are out there. And,
yeah.
And that hacks us all off. And I've talked ad nauseum about that being a short-sighted business model because eventually people figure you out.
Right.
And you're not getting it.
Yeah. You can't exist on an island. Yeah, well, anyway, but speaking about cheaters and copycats, we have Amy Flynn on the show this week talking about somebody who knocked her off and what her experiences were with that.
Yeah, I like what she says about it. And I think it's an interesting talk and I don't want to bury the lead on it. You want to just jump right into Amy Flynn?
Yeah, let's jump into her and we'll talk a little bit more about what some of the stuff she talked about with copycatting after her talk. So here's Amy Flynn from Raleigh, North Carolina.
This episode of the Independent Artist Podcast is brought to you by Zap, the digital application service where artists and art festivals connect.
Great news!
Zapplication has extended their sponsorship of the Independent Artist Podcast into 2023.
This is a podcast, Douglas, that you and I took on that started out as a replacement for the NAIA's newsletter and quickly morphed into something else.
It sure did. It's turned into a place where we can share our voices as professional working artists.
You know, when we first took this project on, it was a pretty small potatoes kind of thing. And as it has grown some serious expenses. So thank you to Zap for helping us take a lot of those on and get these voices heard.
Our tribe is resilient and the stories are so fascinating. So stay tuned for another season of interesting and inspirational conversations on the podcast. Amy, welcome to the show. It is so good to see your smiling face.
Thank you, Douglas. How's your poor little foot?
My poor little foot is on the mend. By the time this airs, I will be in much better shape than I am today. I really miss this interaction with friends, and so I'm so glad I get to sit and talk to you.
Well, that's what I love about this podcast. This is what kept me going through the pandemic. I missed talking to all my artist friends, and then suddenly, there they all were.
It's been fun, and this show has taken on legs. It did actually serve as a form of inspiration for us and for the listeners, too, that it was just more than that temporary period of isolation. So I'm glad that it has kept going.
Yeah, and let it be known to everyone listening that Douglas is high off his ass on painkillers right now, so he can't be held responsible for anything he says. I can, however.
I wish that were true, but nope, I'm clear as day here. I haven't had to have pain meds for a while. I know. It could be kind of fun to get me to loose lips sink ships, as my Aunt Darlene used to say. But what I wanted to say leading in here with you is I've been keeping track of what you and Phil have been up to last year, and you guys really ran right up to the finish line last year, didn't you?
We finished our last show on the 23rd of December, and we're driving home on Christmas Day. Ain't that romantic? Oh, but it was a great show, so that always makes the drive home so much better.
The full pockets make it a celebration no matter where you're at.
Right.
And when it's the two of you, I mean, it's like really home is wherever you are. So
exactly. Christmas at home was in a hotel room somewhere in the South, so... I don't even remember where. They all look the same, the hotel rooms.
Yeah. Fairfield Inns.
Right.
Well, we did an Easter egg hunt for our kids one year, and we do. We kind of adapt as roadies, don't we? You know, the hotels become our surrogate homes.
Well, that's the big thing. We don't have little kids at home, so if we're not home for Christmas, nobody cares but us.
Yeah. So how was your year last year?
I hate to be one of those people that's always bragging about how well they did, because some of those people just drive me crazy. But we had our best year ever last year.
And that's exciting.
Part of it was because it was probably the last year where we had a lot of shows that we were held over to some really good shows because of COVID and the shows that hadn't revived yet from COVID. There was a lot of pent-up buying demand. I can't imagine.
Those first ones out of the gates are just such a dream come true for us. You know,
we had several of those this year, and we broke our sales record three times at three different shows. The final one being, I'm not even going to name it because it'll make too many people mad, because a lot of people had a really terrible show, but we had our best show of all times, and everybody else was wailing and gnashing their teeth, and I'm going, yeah, we did okay.
I'm happy to hear that. And I can also relate to what you're saying, but I think we can say going into 2023, it does feel like we're in this kind of post-pandemic period now. And it makes me wonder, what kind of expectations do we set for ourselves going into the next year?
You know, it doesn't do anyone good to have expectations. You just show up and do your best.
Do you feel like you just go with faith and you just let the chips fall where they may?
You don't know what's going to happen till it's over. So you show up and hope for the best. You can't control the weather or whether there's going to be a recession on. Or I just figure at the very least, I'm going to get to see my friends. So I'm going.
Okay.
But at the
social
same
aspect
time,
is a huge part.
God, yes. But at the same time, we are trying to cut down because we're getting too old for this shit.
You know, I think a lot of our friends who are maybe 10 years older than us, when COVID hit, they said, okay, time for retirement. You know, we're not coming back. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I aged a lot over those 2 years of the break. So, I mean, are you kind of making a plan to be a little like softer or kinder on yourself with the pace and the schedule? Is that what you were saying?
We're trying, but, you know, somebody invites you to a show. It's like, hey, we got in. Let's go. Oh. We did 11 shows last year, and I'd like to keep it at no more than 11. Mm-hmm. Many of you listening know Phil. I cannot do shows without Phil. He is the best roadie in the entire world. But during the pandemic, he tore a tendon. He completely tore a tendon off in his hip.
Those don't grow back.
They misdiagnosed it as bursitis.
Oh, okay.
And long story short, eventually they reattached it. But after over a year of not using those muscles, they've atrophied, and it's been a chore this year to set everything up. The damn robots are heavy.
Yeah.
Every single show we do, at the end of the show, I said, that's it. I'm becoming a jeweler, which I never would do. But I really do think about switching over to a more lightweight form of art, which was one of the plans I had during the pandemic, was to get back to my roots in drawing. And I set up a space in my workshop where I could draw. And after 27 years as a greeting card artist, I could not beat the cute out of my drawing. And it was making me really frustrated. And at that time, the last thing I needed was more frustration. I mean, my God, the economy was in the toilet and there's this deadly disease going on.
So many variables.
We might end up with 4 more years of Trump. And I was stressed out. And I found out the more stressed out I got, the more I was rewarding myself by going into the workshop and making a robot. It's like, okay, 1 more hour at this drawing and then I get to make a robot. I finally realized I don't need this stress. I love making robots. I'm going to do that. And my God, by the end of the pandemic, they were just piling up all over the house. I thought I could do shows for the rest of my life and I will never sell all these robots. And guess what? I sold all the robots.
Well, that was a really great realization where the business-minded side of you was thinking of making a shift based on the challenges that you might have identified. But when you got right down to it, the reason we get into this independent artist business is to do the thing that like charges our batteries and gets us all jazzed. And damn it, robot making gets you jazzed.
I am so lucky to be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was about that insatiable curiosity, that incredible imagination that you have. And I've been across from you at shows, and I feel like we share this in common. That is, when we see people walk by, not everybody, but we do get crowds that kind of like their eyes light up and they walk in and there's like an energy and a vibe that happens. And I feel like you have that imagination with what you make, and people step up and they look at your pieces. And then they laugh, and then they smile.
And then they ask what kind of drugs I'm on.
What kind of drugs are you on, Amy?
As I tell them, don't drink and drill. No, I don't do any drugs. Pot puts me to sleep, and that's about all I've tried. No, I think imagination is so foreign to a lot of people that they figure there must be drugs involved. And okay.
But that's the only way to access it or something, right?
Yeah. No, I found that to be quite the opposite, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm. So you said you came from this corporate illustrator background. Tell me about that.
You know, I've been listening to every single one of your podcasts, and there are quite a few of the people that you've interviewed, including Will, had a background in graphic design and or illustration, as I did. And I spent 27 years first working in-house for companies like Hallmark and Current, if anybody remembers Current. And then I went freelance and was doing children's books and greeting cards and giftware. And I am much happier doing this. But I believe that the 27 years I spent as an illustrator has given me and has given a lot of art show artists a real leg up, because we are in a mindset of having to produce work with other people in mind. It's not just, I am just going to go in my studio and paint whatever floats my boat. And if people don't like it, then they're wrong. No, I come at it from a viewpoint of what do I like to do and what's going to sell? What are those diagrams when you've got interlocking circles? Venn diagrams.
Right. The Venn diagram, yeah.
If you can have a Venn diagram where you're in the middle of making work that is profitable, that there's a demand for, but that's also fulfilling you and makes you want to go into the studio every day, and that you're good at, that you have a talent for, if you can find that sweet spot in the middle, you are golden.
So the illustrator background gave you skills of creating something with kind of a marketing idea in mind of what's going to hit, what's going to resonate with people.
And also problem solving, because you get a lot of art directors that they don't really know what they want, but you have to figure out what
this
they want.
This is too gray. Can you fix it for me or something? They give you something vague.
Show me something different. We could do an entire podcast on stupid art direction that I've gotten over the years. But that said, I mean, I know some of the fine artists look down on us street artists because we are literally selling ourselves on the street and going, oh, a bunch of whores. Well, you know, I'm doing what I want to do. And it just
there
happens to be
aspect.
That it's stuff that people want to buy.
Yeah. And that's not a dirty word. I mean, making stuff that people want to buy is.
Yes, it is. Money's the dirtiest word.
Well, tell me, how did being in this career that you were good at, how did that transition into being an independent artist? I mean, were you feeling like you were stifled?
No, not at all. 2008 happened. In 2008, I was freelancing. I was no longer working in-house. There are very few places that even have in-house artists anymore. I mean, Hallmark is down to just a skeleton crew. They farm everything out because it's a lot cheaper to have artists working on spec. So all of my freelance work dried up. But at about that time, I had started playing around with found objects, and I've always had this kind of bizarre fascination with robots. And I love going to flea markets because it's like a treasure hunt. I mean, if you go to the mall, you know exactly what you're going to find, but a flea market, you could find anything. And I used to make stained glass windows back when I was in college. So I know how to solder. Yeah.
I did that for a little bit, and all of the cuts on my fingers and how slow of a process. I'm like, no, hot glass is definitely my lane.
Well, it was popular back in the 80s when I was doing it. Now it's a hard sell. But it's just like every interest and every skill I've picked up in my entire life just sort of coalesced around these robots.
Okay.
And I found that I was much happier making them than I ever was as an illustrator.
Were you making them just for yourself? Was it a hobby?
It was just a hobby. And I had some very dear friends who owned a craft gallery here in Raleigh, and I showed them what I was doing, and they just sort of looked at me and said, "Why aren't you selling these?" And I said, "I don't know how."
And you probably didn't even know that they were like, we all know your work is good, but I'm sure at first when you made it, you're like, didn't even think it'd be something somebody else would want. You thought it was just for you, right?
Oh, I thought they were great at the time. I look back at my early robots and go, oh my God, I owe an apology to anybody that ever bought these. These are crap. Oh. But they were different. No one was doing anything like it. So I said, well, I don't know how to sell them. I quit the Girl Scouts because I didn't like selling the cookies. Going door to door. And they said, well, you can do art shows. I said, oh, no. Every time I go to an art show, it's either 100 degrees or it's raining. I don't want to do art shows. And they said, well, you can go around to galleries like me. I said, no, did you not hear me about the Girl Scouts?
You had this long list of no-no-nos.
Exactly. And they said, well, we think the best thing that for you would be to go to a wholesale show. So I said, well, okay, that I could handle that. It's indoors, and people would be coming to me.
And it's a way different vibe, too, because selling to people who are going to resell the work has a different level of kind of like distance than like the people who are going to fall in love and own it themselves.
I did the Philadelphia, the buyer's market.
Buyer's Market of American Craft.
It was 2009. It was just March, I think, of 2009. The two gallery owners that coaxed me into doing this, they set me up with an artist that they knew who did art fairs. And she and her brother did this work. And of all of the 1,200 people in the building, he ended up being, by total coincidence, in the booth directly across from us.
Okay.
So we spent the entire weekend going, running over to his booth going, Eric, what do I do? He gave us good advice, but you need to be doing art festivals. So we kept trying to take him out to dinner or buy him a drink or get him lunch. And he kept saying, nope, I'm fine. And finally, at the end, I guess we were pestering him so much, he said, look, if you want to pay me back, the day you get home from this show on Monday is the deadline for the St. Louis Art Fair. I want you to take the $30 or $40 that you would have spent buying me lunch, and I want you to apply to this art festival. And if you don't get in, you'll learn something. And if you do get in, I'll tell you what to do.
Okay.
So, naively enough, we applied.
Right. And not necessarily knowing that this wasn't just like a local show. You're like traveling cross country to a biggie right off the bat.
I didn't know it was such a biggie. I was so naive. I've told people it's kind of like saying, well, golly, I think I'd like to be in a play and then getting cast in a Broadway show.
Exactly. Right.
So we got in and bought a tent, and the first show was the most stressful thing I have ever done in my life. Yeah.
You said you bought a tent. I'm sure you had to buy everything that goes into what you need to do to show up for your first show.
Right.
And you didn't want to do this, but the encouragement of somebody saying you need to do this.
Right.
That's a lot of risk.
Yes. And I was digging into savings because I hadn't had any freelance artwork in over a year. And I was spending all this money buying parts for robots. Right. But the indoor show, the wholesale show, they had a rule that you couldn't use any power tools without getting the union involved. So I designed these columns that you will still see two of usually in my booth at every show, made out of corrugated tin that had this really sort of retro steampunk look to them. Mm-hmm, and they just screwed together. These columns, they looked like they were sitting on top of squashed octopi, that there were all these legs coming out of every single one to try to make them level. And we were such newbies, we didn't realize that the tent had telescoping legs so that you could write it. So the tent was leaning one way and the columns are leaning the other. And then the other thing that the art show had that the wholesale show didn't was little kids. And they were kind of bored at the art show. And then they get to my booth and it's like, oh, toys.
There you go.
And they were trying to pull themselves up on these wobbly columns to get a better look. And things were falling over. And on the opening night, a woman came in and swung around to look at something. And she had a great big bag off her shoulder and it cleared a column full of robots, and she spun around to see what that crash was and dumped an entire glass of wine on Phil. Mm.
These are all the learning curve in this industry. It's true. You know, it can't be underestimated how just showing up for the first time, what we know now after doing it for 15 years or 20 years or whatever, that you just take for granted. And everything was like a catastrophe at every turn.
Right. I mean, at one point, I realized that the kids needed to see what was on the pedestal. So I took some of them off and put them on the ground. And I will never forget that this parents came in and said, okay, hands in your pockets. We look with our eyes, not with our hands. Don't touch. So he puts his hand in his pockets and he turns around to look at his parents. He just glares at them and he walks over to the ones on the ground and kicks one, because he wasn't touching it with his hands.
Right. Well, I mean, that is true. Your work does have that broad age appeal. Do you feel like if you can make them appeal to the kid, that is something that maybe the parent and the child in your booth will bond over and it turns into a sale?
Yeah, actually, now that I have a much better setup, I love having kids in the booth. They are wonderful. They ask the best questions. Most of them are respectful and keep their hands in their pockets. I even have some special ones that I will let the kids play with. So, no, I love having kids in the booth now. But that first show was just such a disaster that I was so stressed out the whole time that it wasn't until we pulled away and got about an hour outside of St. Louis that Phil said, how much money did we make? And I said, I have no freaking idea.
Okay, like a tornado.
So I got out the sales book and it was like, oh my God, Eric was right. We need to be doing art shows. We just made a lot of money.
Okay.
But I really had no idea.
You went through this like whirlwind of experiences, not even being able to keep track and then to look back on it and go, oh my God.
They're right. We need to be doing this. And the problem with wholesaling is I couldn't create a line sheet because everyone is different. It was hard for them to order.
That's exactly right. A store can't come in and order 10 of this particular sample that you've made.
Right.
Because it all just depends on the part you find and the inspiration that you get from it.
Exactly.
I mean, tell me about that process. So first of all, your business name is Phobot, and that stands for?
Found Object Bots. But I also like that it works on that sort of FAUX, faux level as well.
Faux, like FA, yeah, right. Like the French FAU, faux, fake robot.
But then I figured if I called it Phobots with an FAUX, I would probably have killed someone by now going, Foxbots, what's that?
Oh, yeah, there you go. That was good that you didn't go down that road. So I wanted to ask about that process. So when you started building your robots, did you go through the flea markets and you would find these antique parts and bits and you'd say, you know what, this could be a whatever. This could be an elephant.
That's exactly
it. Is that where it came from?
That's exactly it. I used to do theater as well. And by the way, I've noticed a lot of people in your podcast have some sort of theater background as well, which we can touch on later.
But
I used to go to the flea market a lot looking for props because although I enjoy being on stage, I feel that if you have the privilege of being on stage, you should do some backstage work. And I loved building props, which are not the sets, the handheld items that the actors carry. And so I was always at the flea market looking for stuff for shows.
Oh, there's a bit of a scavenger hunt in that regards, like, you know, trying to find the antique telephone that goes on the periods, you know, side table or whatever. And then would you find yourself like falling in love with all these little trinkets that maybe didn't have anything to do with what you were looking for?
Some of them, it's like, well, I'm not going to build the theater for this one. I'm just going to keep this one because if I build the theater and they keep it, they're going to lose it. So I'm keeping this.
So. One for you, two for me, three for me.
And eventually, if you don't start doing something with them, then you become a hoarder.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yeah. So what I'm wondering is which comes first? Is it a drawing of the robot? Or do you find the parts at the flea market and that inspires ultimately what the piece turns into?
I don't draw them anymore. I work in two ways. Well, usually I just find a piece and I put it on the table and then I mix and match other pieces around it to get a feel for how it's going to look. And when I'm happy with the design, then I put it all together.
Start constructing.
But then there are other times when you mentioned an elephant. I knew I wanted to make an elephant. It was years before I was at a flea market and I saw this piece that was a screen door catch to keep your screen door from blowing in the wind. I said, oh my God, that looks like an elephant trunk. And then, then we do elephants.
Yeah. So getting pushed in this direction to do the retail shows where you're making one-of-a-kind pieces and being an independent, how would you compare this lifestyle? What does being an independent artist mean to you versus what you knew beforehand with being an illustrator?
I love the social aspect of it. That's my number one reason. Well, that and making a living, but I have met the most wonderful people. And I find that if I stopped doing it, I would miss them. I would probably become one of those art show junkies that just flies into a show and walks around saying hi to my friends. And they'll say, where's your booth? I said, nope, just here.
I'm just here.
just here.
So those connections, those are the, that's your driving force, aside from the fun of making the work, doing what we do in this kind of market. It is all about those connections.
I wouldn't be talking to you right now without art fairs.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to your illustrator background, what kind of got you on the path towards that? Was it kind of a creative kid who needed to find a good job, so that was a career path for you? Is that what illustration was for you?
My parents were very encouraging, but I don't think they were real crazy about the idea of me being a fine artist. They were much more supportive of me being an illustrator, where I might go and get a job and work for a company. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going to San Jose State University in California that was about an hour away from where we were living, and had one of the best illustration departments in the country, certainly in California. Mm-hmm. And there was always that tension between the fine artists and the whores who were doing it.
Yeah, the sellouts.
Yeah.
Well, what was little Amy like? Were you a little creative? You said you did theater and all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, I was drawing from a very early age, but the theater sort of came because of the drawing. In high school, the theater teacher saw my work in one of the display cases outside the art room, mm-hmm. and said, "Hey, could you do a poster for us?" And from there, it's a short step to, "Could you build these props? Could you paint this picture of Elwood P. Dowd and Harvey? Could you paint this backdrop?" And so I joined the theater class. And eventually, after about 2 years, I was there all the time anyway, working on the sets. Mm-hmm. And eventually I said, "You know what? There's this little tiny part that in The Man Who Came to Dinner, where one of the two neighbor ladies walks in with the calf's foot jelly, and she's on for about a minute. I said, I'm here all the time anyway. I bet I could get that part." Okay. And ended up getting cast in a huge part.
Oh.
So.
That was another, dipping the toe in the water, kind of like the wholesale thing. And then you kind of get pushed into another arena.
And then the exact same thing happened in my adult life. I was living in Colorado Springs and working for Current, and I met Phil, and he was very involved with theater.
Okay.
He was a theater major at University of Texas. It was like, can you do this poster for us? Can you help me with this set backdrop? And eventually it's like, all right, there's this one little character that's just in the last scene. I'm here all the time anyway.
You're saying this is Phil's story? He had kind of the similar thing, what you're describing?
No. This is me. He wrote me into doing all the backstage stuff. Then there's this little tiny role for a girl in the last act. And I bet I could get that. And it got cast in a much bigger part. And it did a lot of theater for many, many years. I miss that too, but it's very similar to doing art shows, except that the auditions are much more painful than applying to a show, because you don't have be there.
Yeah.
You don't have to be there to audition for an art show. You just send the money and some pictures.
You just get the letter back or the email back now. But you don't have to stand face front and see the rejection eye to eye. That is, I can attest to that. That brand of humiliation that is tough.
auditions always made me so nervous. I had to generally take a Xanax or something just to get through them. But being on stage is completely different, because I always felt like it wasn't really me. It was this other person. And this other person always knew what to say.
Well, that is definitely how an introvert can find themselves in the theater and be on stage. People will be like, "Well, that doesn't make any sense. How could an introvert be on the stage?" But you're taking on a different role. You're taking on a different character. It's not you.
Right. You're just losing yourself in another person.
Yeah.
And the only time you'd get popped out of that is when somebody else forgets their lines and suddenly you have to figure out stuff. I don't know what to say anymore.
I had that issue when when we started the podcast, I'm like, this isn't me playing a character. This is what I think, and this is my conversations and what comes to mind for me. And there is a vulnerability there that is just so different that I wasn't prepared for that part of it. So that's been kind of getting me out of my comfort zone.
So you have a theater background too?
Yes. I was a theater major at the University of Northern Iowa. I graduated as an acting major, and I pursued theater as an actor in Minneapolis. And that's where I met my wife. We were both working in restaurants.
I remember that now. So many people have had a theater background. I forgot which ones did.
Yes. Yeah, so I also...
It helps with the art show stuff, too. I mean,
talking to collectors and being right in the booth and yeah, connecting, definitely.
You mentioned introversion and extroversion. Well, I found the textbook definition, for me at least, of the difference between the two is it's like Phil and I. Phil is a total extrovert. He, at the end of the day of talking to people, he's gained energy from talking to people.
Yes.
I am drained by it. But as an actor, I am playing a role as, you know, that funny lady we met at the art show that sold us this robot. But at the end of the day, I want to be someplace quiet with my friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And just decompress and get ready to do it all over again.
I've gotten better at it. When we first started out, it was just assumed that I'd be in the front talking to people and Phil would be in the back wrapping things up. But it worked out to be just the opposite. He was so good at talking to people. And I really enjoyed hiding in the back.
Well, for those who don't know you, you're the whole creative side. You're the artist. You create the work. Phil is your husband, Phil Crone, although Will likes to refer to him as Phil Bott. You're Amy Bott and Phil Bott. But tell us how your partnership works. How does he fit into your partnership and business?
He does absolutely everything except make the robots. He drives to the shows. He helps me set up. He does one thing with the robots that I don't do, and that is early on. Phil also has a background in computer stuff.
Oh,
and
gotcha.
Early on, he said, and he's the one that keeps spreadsheets and is into numbers and things.
Oh,
and
God bless him.
Early on, you know, I do not. The part of my brain that is supposed to hold numbers is just, there's a black hole there. And early on, he said, you know, you need to number these. And I said, hello, have we met? Numbers? No.
Me? How about you number them?
I said, collectors are going to want them numbered. I said, fine, you number them. So we decided on cutting out pieces of sheet copper and stamping the number on them along with the word Phobots.
That's brilliant. And that is the collectible one-of-a-kind nature of it. It takes it up a notch as to making your work special to being collectible. And they've got the one, you know what I mean? Or they've got the 1,715 or something, you know what I mean, of the robots that have been birthed by Amy Flynn.
Right. And he enjoys keeping the spreadsheet. But at the shows, he will sit out front. And of course, everybody assumes he's the artist. He can be wearing a great big badge that says, hi, I'm the assistant. And they will say, well, how did you start making these? And bless his heart, every single time he said, well, you'd be better off talking to the artist, my lovely and talented wife, Amy Flynn, in the back of the booth. I'm the eye candy.
Oh, my God. That is such a great way to approach that. He has such a style about him that he's able to present it that way. That is so great.
He loves telling people he's the eye candy. and sometimes, and it always gets a laugh. And sometimes it gets sort of a pat on the shoulder, like, yes, you are, dear.
Well, it turns misogyny on its ear. I mean, don't you think? The fact that people will typically think that the man is the artist because...
Sure. Because they're robots.
Yeah, but for him to then make a joke at his own expense as being like the diminutive role, the lesser role, and he so gracefully hands the due credit to you.
He is the best. He is absolutely the best. I could not do these shows without him. And I'm so happy that, although he's still a bit weak with the hip surgery, he's not in pain anymore. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But I, like I said, I don't know how many more years of this we have left. He's 72. I'm 62. Well, how did that happen?
No kidding. I took you guys to be each 10 years younger than that. That doesn't even register. Yeah, that is insane. How many more years of unloading a van and putting up a tent do we have in us physically? It is stressful. It is physically difficult.
Yeah. I'm going to be a jeweler. No, I'm not.
There you go. No, you're not. You're going to make robots to wear around your neck.
I do that, but I can't sell them at shows because they could be construed as jewelry. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole multi-category thing, and anybody who wants to make bank can say they're a jeweler, and if they sneak in a different category, that's the big no-no in our business.
I am guilty of that. When I first started doing shows, I was making the little tiny robots that you could wear around your neck, and I never thought of them as jewelry. I thought of them as little tiny robots, and somebody turned me into a show, and they made me take them down, and I want to apologize to every jeweler out there. I was so naive. I am so sorry. I did not mean to offend.
You weren't trying to encroach. I wanted to ask about some of the characters that you come up with. Like, there's some iconic characters, like somebody like, let's say, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or whatever, where there are people who are important to you and you want to do a tribute or a piece that, I mean, what types of people or which characters in like real life influence you in that regard in your designs?
You know, it has to be someone that is there's something so recognizable about them that you can portray them in robot form. And I can't do that with many people. With Ruth Bader Ginsburg, well, her initials are iconic.
Sure.
And then I found some other stuff relating to the law that I was able to incorporate. But most of the time, I don't do characters or individual people. I mean, I really enjoy doing a Wizard of Oz set when I can, because they are so iconic that people recognize them right away. But for the most part, no, I don't. I stay away from real people.
Well, I really get the theater thing because it feels like you're creating characters. You're not just making a robot like, oh, this could be a shoulder, or this could be a head, or this could be eyelashes.
I try to give them personalities, but they're not always based on.
You give them a whole script.
Well, there's the calendar where I actually write their script
for
them.
Yeah.
And give them a story.
But it feels like everyone that you make has a name, and it has a backstory, and it has.
Oh, it does.
It has a life to it, which is theatrical.
Well, thank you. Well, gosh, now that you mention it.
It's like you're writing a little story. Yeah.
I've been told that my booth looks like a theater. So all that set design came into good use.
Absolutely. With like how you create the stanchions across them. So that's a good way to protect them from those fingers to keep them from getting broken and knocked around. The stanchions, almost like you're at a theater, holds them in.
Right.
Give them a little stage.
And it's really more to keep them in when it gets windy than to keep people out.
Oh, sure.
But I like the way it looks.
You even give them heart. Every one of them has their own.
A heart inside, like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, there you go.
The Wizard of Oz was a huge deal when I was growing up because it was on TV once a year.
I remember
that. You rarely saw it in theaters. You didn't have DVD players or movies on demand at the time. It was, you saw it that one time it came on the year, and it was a big event. And
you'd watch it every year.
Exactly.
It wasn't like, I've seen it, so I don't need to see it again. It was like, no, we need to experience it year after year.
Exactly. And of course, I'm making Tin Men, so it just seemed obvious to put a heart in them because that's what the Tin Man wants.
Yeah, he wants the heart.
At first, I only put them in the ones that opened up so you could see it. But so many people were disappointed that theirs didn't have a heart. That very early on, I just started dropping a heart in every single one. And they don't all let you see it, but you can hear it rattling around in there.
So even if you can't, let's say, open the body because it's meant to be closed, the rattling lets you know it's in there.
A lot of the tins open from the top, and if I don't solder it shut, then people do tend to pick things up by the head, and then their body falls off. And that's a rough way to find out there's a heart inside.
So you go to the flea markets, you find these objects that speak to you, and then you craft them and you put them together. And a lot of times you're using, let's say, Old Spice tins from, you know, the 1940s or something. I mean, do you ever find that that use of nostalgia just hooks people?
Absolutely. I mean, I just started using the old stuff because I just liked the way it looked.
Okay.
And but then when I started selling it in public, and people would come in and get teary-eyed. Oh, my grandmother had one of these, or she used this brand of spices. It's really gratifying to see people relate to the objects. I love that.
That happened to us. That happened to Renee when she saw the cap that we bought from you a couple of years back, that spice tin was her grandma, and she had to have it. And it was so special to her, and it's special to us where we have it. It's that I really think that is an important part of making work for the public, is that you can't do it externally where you have to say, well, if I'm going to use this tin, there's going to be people fall in love with it. But if we connect to the sense of nostalgia and then the people come to it, you know what I'm saying? That they find us as opposed to us trying to find them.
Yeah.
Nostalgia has really been hitting me lately with artwork.
Right.
So now I'm going to bring up a topic that might be a little uncomfortable, and we'll just kind of waddle our way through it as comfortably as you feel on it. And that is, you know, you're going about your business. You've had this evolution where you find yourself now at the road shows, and you're making work that energizes you. You're meeting people. You're forming a community. And your work has not been seen, and it's almost like it takes the world by storm. And then you start seeing your work or people saying that they have your work, and you know that you weren't at that market or you've never been where they said they bought it.
Right.
And you start seeing your stuff kind of popping up around the country at different shows. And we've used the term tribute artist.
I love that so much.
But how does it feel when somebody kind of knocks you off?
Well, first of all, I have no issue with people making robots of their own. I think it's fantastic. More power to you. Have fun, kids.
Okay.
But sometimes it takes me years to come up with a design.
Sure.
And it is really discouraging when a couple of months later I go online and I see somebody's made a copy of it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't put in the work. And
they maybe don't even have the creativity that they can put in that work and make it. They just have to steal or take what they've seen.
I'm not letting it bother me because, you know, if it bothers you, you can do one of two things. You can let it eat you alive.
Yes.
Or you can sue. And I don't want to do either of those things.
Well, and suing is so difficult because, honestly, unless you copyright every single robot you make, it's a costly and a process that no independent artist can really, really feasibly do.
Copyright law is such that once a piece of art is in fixed form, it is copyrighted. If you want to get additional damages, you have to copyright it. But I'm not going to do that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
What I've come to the conclusion of in the long run is that anybody who is a real artist, who has the manual skills, who has the vision, who has the sense of design to be a real artist, isn't going to be copying somebody else's work. Mm-hmm. They're going to be doing their own work. And the people that are copying, well, they don't really usually have the skills or the design sense. So the copies aren't as good. And really, the only issue I'm having is that I can't even do shows in certain areas anymore because it has been so inundated by particular tribute artists, shall we say, that all I hear is, oh, we bought one from you 3 weeks ago at name of show I've never done before.
Yes.
And Phil will say, no, we've never done that show. He actually almost got into a fight once with somebody who said, yes, you were there. I saw you. Why are you lying about this? I saw this. No, we really have never been so.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us can run into, like, I'll say for me, someone will be like, oh, yeah, I bought your glass at blah, blah, blah. And people can have this mistaken idea of what your work is just because, it was glass. And then they show you the picture and it looks nothing like your work. But in your case, it is so identifiable and it has its own vision. And so, then I'm sure you go on online and you look at who they've referenced or whatever, and you're like, no, these are knockoffs. These are actual attempts at doing what I do.
Well, and the name Phobot has become so synonymous with found object robots that people, and I have had so many times when people have bought one from a tribute artist and it's broken. So they look up Phobot and they call me and say, it's broken. And I've learned now to say, can you show me a picture so that I can see what parts I would need to order in order to fix it? And they send a picture and say, and that's not mine.
It's not mine. Yeah.
I had a woman at a show in Florida come in just with a really loud voice saying, I bought one of these from you at such and such a show and it just fell apart. And I said, I've never done that show. You're looking for so and so.
And pointing back in the right direction.
Really loud so that the other people in the booth wouldn't think I make robots that just fall apart.
Well, that is.
She was obnoxious anyway.
But that is the deal, too. You don't want to, like, lose the 10 people considering purchasing your pieces to think this is legitimate and your stuff is going to fall apart. So you kind of have to be diplomatic on how you kind of handle it and get her out and move it along.
Yeah, I just made sure to be even louder than her.
Okay, so no diplomacy, just get out.
Use my theater voice. That is not my robot. No, a couple of years ago, I woke up one morning and I turned on my computer and I've got like 15 Facebook messages, which is unusual.
Yeah.
So I start clicking on them and one of them is from Will and it's... And they were all saying, Amy, go to such and such. I guess it was art show jury evaluate, where you go to get help with your jury pictures.
Gotcha. Right. One of those evaluation sites. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had like 15 people saying, Amy, go to this site. So I went there and there is what at first glance I thought was one of my robots, but it wasn't. It was so close. I mean, right down to the purse that the robot was carrying.
Wow. So people had your back.
People always have my back. They don't need to defend me. They, you know, just if you see a knockoff at a show, just be nice to them. They're just doing their best. I'm doing okay. We just had our best year ever. So obviously it's not impacting my ability to make a living. So go ahead, make robots, but try to find your own voice.
Yeah.
You'll be much happier if you do.
Well, right, because there's the integrity behind it. The satisfaction of making something, not just that you constructed and sold, but something that you dreamed up and sold. I mean, that's really the key right there. That's the glorification of the redemption behind it is that somebody wants what came out of your magical brain.
Yes, my magical brain.
Well, if anything, I think maybe it's provided you with a sense of resilience because, I mean, they can maybe take what you've done and what you're doing, but they can't anticipate what comes next, you know?
Well, and I am grateful to the copycats because it has spurred me on to try to make better and better work, to try and make things that are more and more difficult to copy.
So those are the puzzles you have to solve. You said being a puzzle solver has been a big part of your life.
Yeah.
So that's a puzzle to solve.
Sure. And I hope I continue to evolve. I mean, I remember seeing an interview with somebody, I think it was maybe Pablo Casals, who was still practicing in his 90s. And somebody says, you're good at this. Why are you still practicing? And he said something like, because I think I'm starting to make some progress. I really thought that by now people would be tired of these robots and would have moved on to the next thing, but they're still buying them and I'm still enjoying it and I hope I'm still getting better at it.
Well, that copycatting has baked in the cake for you this mentality of striving to be better. It didn't put you back on your heels. I mean, I have always thought that your superpower is your imagination. And so they are pushing you to keep that imagination fresh, and you're solving those problems. And I find inspiration from that.
Thank you.
Well, I think we have kind of come to a conclusion point here. This has been a great talk, Amy.
Well, I'm looking at my clock here, and you've got 2 more minutes here.
Should we fill? We'll do a little stretch.
I was so worried when you said you wanted to talk to me. I think I told you that I've never crossed the ocean on a raft to gain my freedom. I haven't danced on the top of a bar to get beer money for my dad or cut off half my hand. I've led the most privileged white bread life imaginable. Complete suburbia and Catholic school. And
I understand that. I understand where you're coming from there. A lot of these stories that we've had, I mean, I didn't know all of this background about artists. And I start talking to people and we hear these stories that are so profound. And on the surface, yes, what you just listed off are 3 pretty interesting, great stories. But I don't want to underestimate your story. And it's the imagination and the creativity. It really speaks to who we are as people, as who we are as independent artists, who want to have this life of having connections with other people, making what we want to make, getting inspired by what we make, and being our own boss. And I mean, that's it right there. You know, that's the Amy Fobot story. And that's what we love about Amy Fobot, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, have a good one, Amy, and thanks so much for sitting down and talking to me today.
It's been great.
All right, have a good one.
Okay.
Bye.
You know, Douglas, when we first started this project, Amy has always been one of the people that I thought we would interview. She's out there. She knows a million different people, and she talks about the social aspect. We all know her, so I'm glad we finally got her on the show.
I think it's really funny what she said about how, well, when I first approached her, she was like, I didn't have all this dramatic stuff happen to me. What are we going to talk about? We just talk about our experiences. It was a great talk. I love it. I love talking to her.
Yeah. Nice chat with her. And thanks again, Amy, for being on the show. And, you know, sometimes I feel like there are these partnerships, but if you walk into the Fobots booth, Phil immediately deflects to her. He's like, nope, not the artist.
Right.
You know, like
he's the eye candy. Like, hey. How about that one? He's the eye candy.
Yeah. I especially like it when Phil is out there setting up the show and he's got his sexy sweatband on over his head. It's John McEnroe.
That's awesome.
That's a good look, Phil. It's a good look.
But this was a good talk about, you know, being thankful to the tribute artists. Who would have ever thought that would be something she might say, that it pushes her to be better at what she does. I was kind of surprised that was what came out of her mouth.
Yeah, that was bullshit.
It was a thank you, tribute artist.
Yeah, thanks a lot, tribute. I'm going to burn you to the ground. No, I do appreciate that gratitude idea. It's tough. I'm sure she'd like for that not to exist, but it does. And it's a fresh way to handle it.
It is. It's to know that she can always be thinking of what's next, that she's got the real gift, which is the creativity. So the creativity, it's a limitless pool that she can keep doing new stuff, where other people are chasing, you know, they're chasing the inspiration.
Her last design.
Yeah, they're chasing her last design. Exactly.
Right. So. And I liked what she said about that. But I mean, you've got these people out there and some of them may be listening. Look, you know, out there, if you're being ethically lazy.
Sure.
You know, you're like, well, this is an idea, but this is like a different thing. So it's okay. It's okay if I do this because it's different. It's like, you know, deep in your heart that you didn't really come up with that. You know, there's one artist that I used to know pretty well. And I was fairly decent friends with them, neighbors, and they decided to just start ripping off another artist down to the paint color of their walls and the photography style and the frames. You know, there's a cost of being ethically lazy. You don't get any friends. Yeah. Those guys don't have any friends. If you're cheating, they're an analog artist and they're selling reproductions. They're stuck in their booth. They don't really get to talk to people. They're missing out on one of the main portions of what even Amy says, is like she misses the camaraderie. I know
the social aspect.
Yeah,
is huge.
I know how much you're missing that right now. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge part of what we do. And
the authenticity, it comes down to it for me, because this business is hard enough as it is, the setting up, the selling, the going on to the next one. But for it to feel like there's a hollow integrity or a hollow authenticity behind it, because that's really, for me, what makes me get back on the road after a bad show, or to really feel on cloud nine when I've had a great show. And that is the stuff that we dreamt up, Renee and I, it hit or it didn't hit, and I want to get another crack at it. You know what I mean? And it's all about that integrity with the work. And if that's missing, if it's all about just being a salesperson, man, you sure picked a hard industry to just sell stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly. Once you just, you know, if you're just about selling, there's a lot easier things to do. Just go sell hot dogs.
Yeah, right. Well, on that fine note, I think that's a wrap for this week. Great talking to you, Will. Everyone else out there, have good shows, make big bucks, enjoy your time in Florida, and we'll see you the next time.
That's right. Be kind to each other on the social media. Quit getting into your little bitch slappy fights. March will be here before you know it.
Yes, it will.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Association of Independent Artists. The website is naiaartists.org.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. That's zapplication.org. And while you're at it, find us on social media and engage in these conversations.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to be notified when we release new episodes.
Oh, and if you like the show, we'd love it if you would give us your 5-star rating and offer up your most creative review on your podcast streaming service. See you next time.